Get ready to be part of the Compassionate Revolution, where Loose Tea Music Theater brings you conversations about the future of opera. This podcast is hosted by founder Elaine Avio, and together, we're opening doors, breaking down barriers, busting myths, and sparking public discussion all in the name of making space for change. Social justice is our compass, and opera is the way forward. Will you join us on our mission to create a more compassionate and inclusive world through opera? Let's make a difference together.
Hi, I'm Elaine Avio, founder of Loose Tea Music Theater. This is Compassionate Revolution. Today, I'm talking with Saman Shafi, who is a Juno Award-nominated composer, music director, educator, and so many other hats like executive director and production person, et cetera, when we get into all of the various things of production. I'm so excited to have him on with us today because he has worked with me at Loose Tea Music Theater as a music director and helped with our BIPOC Composer Librettist Development Program. And we have had many conversations one-on-one, but I'm excited to bring to a wider audience. So let's jump into it. So welcome, Saman.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I guess we're kind of free-forming it today. Yeah. And I'd like to, there's something that I've been thinking about that we have touched on. And that's because we both hold these positions as executive director of, you know, small organizations. But that really came about because we were artists who then, you know, you need money to do stuff and you need a group of people together to do things. So you kind of end up becoming like an executive director, even though
by force
you were just an artist. By force. And I've been kind of fascinated or interested in, or actually maybe frustrated is the term, with kind of how we end up having to fundraise and get money for our various projects. So like for Loose Tea, we've been, so how long has ICOT been?
ICOT's been alive and well ICOT since 2011. So we're now entering our 12th year, actually. Or wrapping up our 12th year, actually. So entering the 13th.
Yeah. And Loose Tea has been around for 10 years. We're actually in our 10th year anniversary season, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, since 2013. And so we've been like project based, which essentially means that we get money for a project and then that's it. Like there's no money for operations. And I think that's how ICOT works, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And just recently we got, you know, a little bit of core funding from the Ontario Arts Council, which means that we can, like, there is some operating money, but it's only like $25,000. And yeah, I've been like kind of frustrated with like, there's like never really enough money to do the full project or to like pay us or, you know, and like, how do we figure that out? Because I personally, I've massively burnt out by the fact that like you just put a ton of time and effort and soul into these projects and there's no kind of system for like, how the hell do we get paid?
We never get paid. That's the thing. It's actually funny because I literally had a meeting yesterday with people because we just wrapped up a big recording and we're just kind of, you know, debriefing about things. And both the other two are like, Saman, you need to make sure you get paid properly next time. Because like, we need to budget it in a way because you put in like, you know, 300%. And I'm like, guys, we had this conversation every big project. You know, every big project we sit down after, like, we need to pay someone more, okay? Because he just he did like 7,000.
Because you're doing everything.
Yeah. And then we end up not doing that because we have to chip away at our own fees because we need to fund and finance other things like musicians getting paid, the venue getting paid, promotion, blah blah blah. So it's one of those conversations that we're always like, whenever we're budgeting at first, we're like, okay, no, we're going to put in this amount of money for my time. And then we're like, okay, well, maybe we just take this much of it for a venue. Maybe we take this much of it for a musician. And then you end up with either very little or no money.
And like, as the executive director, you're kind of like, well, we need this amount of money. Yeah. So where is it going to come from? And
my
you're like,
fee.
I guess it's my
it's
fee.
Fine. It's fine. And because of these, and it's the funny thing with Lucy and with ICOT is that it's not like you know, we're not just curators that we receive somebody else's work and we just put it on stage. but we also have a vested interest in it because it's oftentimes our own work. Like, you direct the operas that you put on, or we write the music that we're recording and putting on concerts. So, you know, it's not like some stranger just giving us work and we're like just contractors. We're actually like the producers of these works. So they have like intrinsic value and they're dear to our hearts. So we want to put it out. So we're like, you know what? My pay is cut. It's fine, whatever. It's my own work. So you kind of justify it in your head. In a funny way that you shouldn't receive the amount of money. It would be nice to be like the executive director for one of these bigger companies that actually have like massive operating grants that they can actually pay, you know, like a salary. I've never been salaried in my life. I don't even know what that means. It must be so nice to know that how many, no, you know, because I'm sure like executive directors, for example, at, I don't know, Soundstreams or National Ballet also work 300 hours a week, but at least they know they have a salary. But in our case, it's a fragile, vulnerable situation financially.
Yeah, where there is no salary, and then there even isn't really any fee at the end of it because we use it for the project itself. Yeah. And for Loose Tea, like, some of the projects are mine, and, you know, like, either projects that I'm either directing or that I'm actually writing, or I'm a part of the creative team. But there are pieces that I haven't actually been either the creator or the director. Mm-hmm. And that passion comes from like really wanting, you know, deep down a primary ethos is like to be able to support other people and give a platform, because I feel like there's not that many platforms. And you have, you know, in order to do that, you have to do what we've done, which is create these companies. And then you're doing exponentially more work in order to just get work on stage. And so, you know, what we're trying to do is kind of provide a platform for other people to be able to create and have their works be supported in creation to potential, you know, performance. But what we realize at Loose Tea is that actually, you know, 80% of our work is actually development and experimentation, explorations, and maybe only 20%, maybe 15% goes onto the stage. It's also opera, which is way huger. Yeah. But, you know, what you said about these other companies that kind of are like 40, 50, 60 years old or something, having these budgets where they can pay their executive director and artistic directors a proper salary. I mean, grandfathered is the term.
Yeah.
Kind of like they've been in, or they got in at a time, I think, when there was a lot of funding for this type of stuff.
And not a lot of competition. Now, which is just perfect.
Yeah, not a lot of competition at the time. And now it feels like there are a number of smaller companies like, you know, I caught in Loose Tea, and that we just can't really seem to get our foot in the door, or there's so many more, I'm going to call them barriers, because it's like qualifications and things that you have to do, like CADAC. You may know what CADAC is, and I hope you never have to know, or maybe you do and you get funding and it's lovely, but it's like the most freaking frustrating thing on the planet, which is just like a government like reporting and qualification system that like you have to have in order to have any operational funding. But it's actually a huge barrier for small companies like us
who are already overstretched with their resources, and they don't have the time to prepare these documents, fill out 10,000 extra forms, and, you know, because it's oftentimes one person doing most of the work.
Or even really the expertise as well. Yeah. Like we are artists that were kind of forced into executive positions.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. And you're like, how much do I need to learn? And what?
It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. It's absolutely nuts. The things I have to do or know, you know, from marketing all the way to, I mean, that's, I guess, in a way, that's the story of being an artist in this day and age. You know, 150 years ago, you just played an instrument or sang or wrote music or conducted. At best, you may have done two of those things. You just went about your day. But now with the advent of technology and everything, you have to be a video editor. You have to be an audio editor. You have to know how to market. You have to know like a slew of things that are just not taught in school, nor does anybody tell you. It's really funny. I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine who also works for one of these big companies. And we were talking about how we're never taught like how to apply for jobs or apply for certain positions or reach out. Like even for networking, for example, you never...
Networking, oh my God.
You never taught how to do that. And And one of my biggest fears is that, have I been doing it wrong this whole, like, I'm 36 years old. Have I been doing it wrong for the past, like, decade and a half? Because nobody tells you. And then maybe, like, your tone of the email is incorrect, or the way you attach your files is incorrect, or the way you introduce yourself is off-putting or something. But, you know, these are really important things that you have to know now. And this, and you know, in addition to all the executive things you have to do, is overwhelming.
And I think some institutions are teaching some of those aspects now, but like the funny thing is, like, you go into a music degree for the purpose of learning music and becoming a really great musician.
That's right.
And not only do you need to be a really great musician or composer or whatever, but you also now need to be a great marketer, a great, you know, networker. And if you're not a great networker or a great marketer, you may never get out there.
That's very true. It's really tough. The fact that we don't learn about it, and we have to learn about it through a lot of trial and errors, and we probably have to, like, burn a lot of bridges. You know what I mean?
Like, burn a lot of bridges. Yeah. Oh my God. Yes.
As a result.
Or like being like, I remember, especially when I started, like now I think I am much better at networking and marketing now. I would hope so after so many years. But I definitely remember when I first started and I was like, you have to, Elena, oh, there's that person, you need to go talk to them. And I was like, I don't know how to do this and I'm going to look like an idiot. And you go and you look like an idiot anyways, and you can hear yourself saying things and you're like, I know this isn't right and I know that this is like not giving a good impression, but how else are you going to learn how to do it?
No, that's still true. I still do that when I'm talking to somebody who's really, really important, and I like, okay, I just force myself into it. I just start mumbling and it's incoherent sentences come out. I'm like, well, this is not me. You got to give me another minute, and then just walk away. So that's usually the case with me too.
And then you wonder, like, how much is that? I mean, because the thing is, like, you have to practice doing it. Yeah. Otherwise, you're never going to learn how to do it. But you also wonder, how much is that actually impacting my career?
Yeah.
That this is the first impression, or maybe even the second impression that these people are getting. And you're like...
Yeah. That's one of the reasons that I believe it's better to be a late bloomer. Because some of these good opportunities and really important people should come in a little bit later in your career. Not like right at the bat, unless you're one of those like really emotional, like with the highest EQ possible, and you're just good at talking to people. I'm not. My EQ is not great, so it's good that some of these opportunities or some of these important key people should come in a little bit later, where you have the capability of properly communicating your thoughts. And because what is the point of networking? Networking is that you want to profile yourself and your vision to somebody who can make it happen. And if you aren't quite there in terms of just communication skills or just confidence, or that's why I'm a believer in that. You know, if an opportunity doesn't come right away when you're 22, it's probably for the best, because you'll be better equipped in 10 years down the road or 15 years down the road to handle it. So
yeah, I agree. But there does feel like this push, and I don't know where it's come from, this like idea and this push that you need to be really good very young, and that you need to be networking and you need to be putting yourself out there. I mean, I kind of dislike the CBC 30 under 30 or something.
I hate those so much. And you never feel like, good reading. Like if you are under 30 and you're reading it and you're not on that list, you're going to feel like garbage.
Oh, hold on. Let's just explain if people don't know what the CBC 30 under 30 is. So it's essentially a list of like 30 best, quotation mark, musicians or extraordinary musicians under the age of 30.
In that
and
year.
This list comes out every year for that year. Yeah. So like best 30 under 30. So yeah, so go ahead. Like, yeah, we read it and like, you don't feel good.
No, you don't feel good at all. Cause if you're under 30 and you're not on that list and you feel like you deserve to be on that list, well, there you go. You're shortchanged. If you're over 30, you feel like you've missed the boat. So somehow you've lost. You've already failed as a musician, because look at all these under 30 year olds that are doing such amazing work. And what are you doing with your life? So it's like, it's further perpetuates this It's like, as though we don't have Instagram and Facebook already making us feel like shit every day about what everybody else is doing. Now we have this extra list that's, you know, supported by this Canadian broadcast company. And it's like, yeah, here you go. Here's 30 more reasons you should be not feeling good about your career. Yeah.
And especially for like singers. I'm just saying that because, you know, I trained as a singer and I work with a lot of opera singers. Like, your voice isn't going to mature until you're older anyway.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, you know, to be under 30 on that list for a singer is really challenging. Mm-hmm. And if you are, that then puts a lot of pressure on you to, like, continue being really good or the best or something. But, like, singers aren't going to end up on that that list very often because, like, you know, your voice just doesn't even, like, develop. Your instrument isn't even developed yet.
I think it has something to do with this idea of expedited growth, I think it's, or expedited excellence. I don't think, I don't understand why we're in such a rush to reach that excellence. It might have to do with the sort of the way our economy is built, that like speed, you know, like you need to get there. Like, right. I buy something off Amazon, it needs to be here in 2 minutes. If it's not in here 2.5 minutes, then it's failed. The system has failed. So it's this like obsession that we have with getting there really quickly. And I'm often like, whenever I'm reading, I'm always fascinated by people who are either doing their own thing and they're hermits and nobody knows about them, and then they suddenly, like, you realize there's this whole body of work and that ends up being huge. Or people who bloom really late. Whenever, like, I'm reading a composer's CV, usually, like, you know, for the first 10, 20 years, nothing is happening. And suddenly, like when they reach 55, like, a whole lot of things happen. And it's just so exciting. It's like, wow, they reached this pinnacle point after 20 years of going through things and failing and learning, and something happened. That you can't get that when you're so young. It also reduces pressure on you as a young person, as a 20-year-old, that you need to be like this already there. Like, no, you have like 20, 30 years of just experimentation time and finding yourself time.
And life, actually, exactly what you just said, finding yourself and like life experience. Like, these people who, as you said, you know, you look at their resume and you're looking at their artistic resume and they've done kind of nothing for a few years or something, but it's not doing nothing as an artist. You know, existing in the world as an artist is still being an artist, even if you're not outputting.
Yeah.
And that time is actually, you know, accumulating experiences and world education.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess.
Absolutely.
And experimentation as well, of like just being a human. Yeah. That actually all coalesces, you know, into being able to create art that I think, you know, actually maybe speaks more profoundly. I mean, like, if you look at, I mean, yes, you know, if we want to look at like early Mozart, yeah, there's some good stuff, but is it like profound?
Not yet.
I don't think it's profound.
Yeah.
Not yet.
Yeah.
And I think that like glamorizing all of like, you know, this young creation or young artistry, it puts a ton of pressure on them. Like, I know I felt
absolutely
pressure.
Yeah.
And I don't think it allows us to actually, you know, find ourselves or, you know, develop into an actual artist, you know, it with all of the components that we need in order to express that art. Right.
Yeah. I remember, I'm not going to name names, but I applied for a composer residency with a very important Canadian organization. I'm not going to name names. This is 10 years ago. And the feedback, I didn't get it. And when the feedback came back, I'm 25 years old. So over a decade ago, the feedback was, composer seems to be unfocused doing a lot of different things. It would be better to associate yourself with more serious composers to find that sort of voice. I'm just thinking, I'm 25 years old as a composer. I'm a baby. I'm not supposed to have a voice yet.
Yeah.
I'm supposed to go around like a child in playground and play and you know, cut myself a few times and fall down and just like see what works and what doesn't work. What can I do, what I can't do? And like, how do you expect a 25-year-old to have a compositional voice? We're not all Mozart, you know.
And fail.
Yeah, it's important. It's so important.
And be able to fail as well.
Yeah.
Kind of connecting that back with like the organizations that we have, you know, this idea that, you know, we kind of need to be able to fail.
Mm-hmm.
sometimes to be able to be artists and to be able to learn, but that like our the structures of our funding are such that it feels like every time we do something needs to be fantastic or perfect or like at a high level every time. And I know I feel that pressure as well of like, A, I need to be outputting, like I need to be constantly trying to output, and B, that it has to be at a high level, otherwise like maybe I won't get funding next time.
And I think it's important that as people who run these companies, even though we're the smaller babies income, I think it's important that within our projects and within our various endeavors, we allow space for that failing or for shortcomings or for just allowing space for learning. I think because I don't really call it failing, it's more like learning. You learn, okay, that didn't
work. Learning.
But I think just because everything is just so razor sharp and everything's just so accurate, and scheduling usually doesn't allow for these things. But you know, we should allow it. Like if you have a bunch of composers over for a workshop, you need to, and I know Lucy does that, like with that workshop that we did last year. Gave plenty of time to composers, to music directors, to musicians, to just experiment, see what works, what doesn't work. And I think that's super important because it really allows for organic learning and organic growth for all the creatives that are involved.
And that I think that the creators themselves also need to understand that it's okay for something to not work out and then to go back to the drawing board, like even that night, and be like, okay, that didn't work. How do I figure out the next step? And even if that next step doesn't work out or the step after that doesn't work out, that process of like trying to make it work is actually going to lead to something, and that's okay to like fail. And it's okay for things to also not move forward. I think that's the other thing, is that we have these babies of creation, and that sometimes that creation actually just isn't going to get on stage. But it doesn't mean that the time that you spent creating it, you know, was at a loss. Right? Like that time that you spent creating and trying to solve problems and come to some sort of, you know, product, even if it doesn't reach the stage, you still have all of that process that you gained and all the input from people like you, people like the musicians, that you can store into your, you know, storing yourself as an artist and then bring out, you know, later.
Absolutely.
Have you had that opportunity?
I think so. I mean, I definitely had works that kind of were semi-staged or never really got off the ground, or parts of it were written and it didn't go anywhere. But you definitely learn from it. Sometimes I wrote a couple of things during the pandemic, for example, that I keep trying to plug in, which I'm proud of. Like I wrote an orchestral piece, for example, that I wrote at the very beginning of the pandemic because I just put this sort of series of restrictions on myself, and I wanted to see if I can operate as a composer. Just to see.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah, just to see if I can write an orchestral piece, for example, not using any melodic.
Like what? Like what?
Like not using any melodic or motivic ideas, just using color. Because that was something that I felt like I was lacking as a composer, that I wasn't able to work just with color. And I just wrote something, and I was really proud of the result, and I sent it over to some more senior composers, and they're all like, yeah, it's really good. I've been plugging it to various orchestras since 2020, 3 years, nothing.
Kind of like etudes or something.
Yeah, well, like it's a 5-minute piece. It's actually very palatable. Like, you know, it's like this like really nice. It can fit into any program. But and sometimes I think to myself, like, I really like to for that work to receive a world premiere finally one day. And maybe it won't. I don't know. But I always think about it as such a fantastic learning opportunity where I had to like challenge myself to write something. And I think what I learned from that piece, it sort of was transferred. That knowledge or that technical craft. So you're absolutely right that sometimes I get upset when I don't hear back from orchestras. I'm like, but what I got from that piece was already so important that even if it doesn't receive its own moment of recognition, it's not a waste. It wasn't a waste of time. I'm still proud of that work.
And it's found its way into, like, probably that exercise found its way into your composition since then.
Absolutely. I would like to think so. I mean, that's probably it. It's important. So I think it's all important also for composers to know that patience is an important thing, and sometimes things don't happen right away, or they never happen. So you kind of have to like find a way to deal with it, because as you said, these are our babies that we create and then we send out to the world. So it's important that you don't always expect that it receives recognition and multiple performances or stage. You know, it's just it It's not always the case, unfortunately.
And it doesn't mean that you're less of an artist, right, yeah, either. If, like, for some time something doesn't get published or put on stage or whatever, but that is all like building blocks in the process of being an artist.
Yeah, absolutely, right? Absolutely, 100%, 100%.
So, I just want to like touch back on kind of some of the so we're artists, mm-hmm. and you know we trained as artists. We you know didn't you know expect or really know that we were going to have to be writing budgets and making marketing plans and reporting to the government. And we learn these things as we go. Yeah. And, you know, like, for example, this recent recording, which why don't you tell us what the recording is and when it's coming out?
Might as well. Sure. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So it's a recording titled, the album titled Recurrence by ICOT Chamber Orchestra, which is made up of some of Canada's best musicians. So the New Orford String Quartet, for example, and National Ballet flute players and clarinet players. So it's a chamber orchestra piece album, and it features five new pieces for that orchestra. My piece, Maziar, and Kian's piece, and also Nicole Lizé and Jordan Nobles. And so it's going to be a really cool album. And they all revolve around the idea of repetition, how that affects us as humans, or also how it just reverberates in the universe. So some people took to ecology, some people took to politics, some people took to mathematics. It's a very interesting thing. It'll come.
And when does that come
it's
out?
It's coming up October 13th. Friday the 13th. October 13th. So it's going to be very
cool. Ooh!
I hope that's not a bad omen.
I like Friday the 13th for this, though. So, you know, give me, so you're a composer on this, you're also playing on it. So, like, give me, so, you know, you're doing all the executive work, yeah, producing work to get, you know, this recording happening. And then on the day, what does your day look like when you're
in the studio,
you know, having to do in the studio?
Yeah, I literally had to turn off my phone and go, okay, and then, you know, just sit in the studio and then tell my friend, one of the other ICOT people who was outside, say, you're now me. I want to be in there and I want to be a musician because we need to record this thing, and I need to, like, my 120% focus needs to be on this instrument and on my ears, on my, like, on the conductor. Like, I can't be, you know. So that's where I get a little nervous, that all this work that I'm doing, is it distracting me from what's actually important, which is the music and the work that we're producing? So that's one of the biggest anxieties I have when I have to do all of this work, just to make sure that in the end I'm able to fulfill my function as a musician and not be carried away with all the other stuff. There has been concerts, for example, that we did with ICOT where I'm on stage playing and suddenly my brain goes into, like, oh, the rental van that we parked, did I pick the parking fee enough? And I'm like, jump. You know, it's ironic that you're like, you did all that work, but because of the overwhelming amount of responsibility that you have, they creep into your head while you're doing the very thing set out by the entire effort. So that's where I get a little scared. Ironically, you get overwhelmed enough that it takes over. Like, the task of making the budget becomes more important than the music itself. So that balancing act is really, really tough. And I always struggle with it. Always, always.
Yeah, so essentially you're trying to, like, delegate, like, yeah, hey, can you take these hats yeah off of my head
for 20 minutes
so that I can try to just be the musician? Yeah. Which is the thing that, like, we trained and trained for and wanted to be. I feel sometimes, especially when I'm directing something that I'm also producing, I feel like I don't get the time to actually put in, you know, I don't get enough time to put into my artistic part, like, to just be a director, because of all of the other mm-hmm things that come up, having to produce or, you know, production manage or whatever, you know, and that kind of, it really sucks. It really hurts,
yeah,
sometimes when you're like, I just want to sit down and, you know, do the artistic part. I just want to sit down and, you know, do my staging of re-listening of, for me, analyzing the music again to make sure that I'm communicating what the composer was hoping for. And what can I find? Like, what little bits can I find that are fascinating and interesting? Because that's the interesting yeah part about being, you know, a musician who became a director yeah is teasing out those, for me, teasing out those musical, you know, the musical analysis to make sure that my direction is being supported by it. And, you know, you just think like, okay, I'll get this budget done and then I can, you know, whatever. Okay, I'll do these slew of emails and then I'll get to whatever, you know, I'll get to the artistic part. And then you realize that the artistic part is getting like
less and less time.
Less and less and less. And you haven't done this, that, or the other thing. And now you're like a month away from the thing and you're like, shit. Yeah. I still haven't done all that artistic stuff I wanted to do.
And even when you sit down to do the artistic thing, those other things are still in your brain playing around and poking. And then maybe even you're it's such in my case, you do this really, really stupid thing where you leave your email notification on. So when you're doing your thing, the notification comes on and you see an email, you're like, I should probably get to that. And then that's it. It's game over. So you're like, even the moment that the precious little moments that you have musically or artistically, they vanish. So it's hard to do that. It's really hard to do that, to sort of balance it in a way that, you know, you can still be an artist, compartmentalize your brain in a way that can do both. But when a project is really big, what are you going to do? You know, you're stressed about it. You have no idea for this very recording how many times I would go to the budget every single day just to make sure that I'm not making some colossal mistake that's going to run us to the ground, you know? Like, I would lose sleep over it. Like, it's not a joke.
Because in the end, like, you are responsible.
Yeah.
And you know what? If you go over budget, guess who's paying for it? The amount of times that I've gone, I don't think people understand this. The amount of times that I've actually personally gone into debt to make sure that somebody else gets paid properly. Because I can't stand the idea of somebody being shortchanged, you know, because I don't know, my grant wasn't good enough and we didn't get a certain amount of money or, you know, we didn't, you know, get a donor on board that I thought we were going to. Oh, that's the other thing. Donor relation. Have you had to deal with that?
It's funny because we've had donors, we've had sponsors before, but nobody that would, because I think that donors are usually people who are more long-term as opposed to sponsors that are like project-based.
Yeah.
I've never had to deal with that, thankfully. I've dealt with sponsors plenty, but not donors. So that's sort of like the long-term relationship that you have to build with them. Thankfully, because I think that's probably really a lot of work.
It is. And that's like something more recently that I've recently in the last few years. And even with foundations, you kind of have to have they're kind of like donors as well. Like you have to have long-term kind of constant communication. And you're like, this is actually crushing me because it's like another thing. On top of all the other responsibilities. And I got to this place where it's like, there's so many things I have to do and they kind of want a piece of you. Like not in a bad way, but like they want to be part of the process. Yeah. They want to be connected with you as an artist. And I understand that, but like it is the next thing on top of all those things that just feels like crushing.
Yeah, like you're already so stressed, so thin. And they just want an extra little thing, so.
And it's like, I do want to give that to you, but then I actually have to take time away from the art again.
That's right. Yeah.
Like, the thing that you're actually wanting to see happen.
Yeah.
And it just, it seems like system, I don't know, the system doesn't work.
Yeah. No, I know. And, I mean, in brackets, I must say that, you know, every time I've worked with Loose D in any capacity, I was always well paid and paid in time. So if you're one of those organizations that actually pays properly and pays in time, you know, at ICOT, we're the same way. Like, I will not be able to sleep if somebody's not paid or if somebody's not paid properly or if I know they're not happy about what they got paid. So we always write contracts. I make sure that everything's discussed ahead of time because these things are important to me when somebody hires me. And when I get shortchanged, I get really angry because I think I put all this work to make sure other people get paid. So I expect that from the community, but sometimes you don't get that. So I just want to put that in brackets that, you know, you're actually putting your money where your mouth is. You're actually walking the walk and not just talking the talk. You know, you're actually doing it. But it's insane. It's insane the amount of responsibility that you have. Like we've thought about personally, I've thought about like, what if we have interns at these organizations? What if we have like volunteers who come in? But then you're like, okay, if I have to train this volunteer to do this X and Y and Z, and then they have to do all this work for free. You know, how long can I take somebody's time you know, like eventually I have to pay them with either a letter of recommendation or an actual monetary something. Like you can't just constantly use somebody for free. Like,
and internships, like I fundamentally disagree with internships, because you should, I mean, I really am more of like the union model of like, you should get paid to learn to do a skill.
Yeah, absolutely.
Personally, I think you shouldn't have to pay yourself, especially in an industry that already pays so little. Like maybe if it's like, you know, a big banking thing or whatever, maybe because you know that eventually you're going to be making, you know, $200,000 a year. And so you can kind of go into debt and that's fine. But like with music, you're not really going to make a lot of money.
No. So
I can't really justify having interns work for free without it killing my soul.
Yeah. No, it's true. I very, very intimately understand that. It's you have to make sure that people are paid and they're happy.
And even like the summer jobs stuff, like I really need to get on that. Yeah. But still, as you said, like you bring somebody in and you want to make sure that you're mentoring them properly and you're not just like, oh, here, do all this, you know, do all the, you know, really awful jobs. But even those like need a lot of explanation and shepherding.
Handholding, because you have to.
And handholding, because they're in a teaching or like you're in a learning teaching kind of position. And it's kind of like the amount of energy that's going to take to teach those people how to do things, I could just do.
Yeah. And then 3 months later, they're gone probably because.
Yeah.
So it's not a very efficient system.
I mean, it's not. So I'm jumping off of kind of all these, what we've talked about so far. Like I personally ended up in a place of burnout, but you know, we tried to do a lot, maybe too much. Honestly, but Lucy was trying to like jump that gap or jump that from like producing, you know, one big thing and maybe a second small thing to like, you know, having a full program, you know, getting more money, having more staff, like trying to jump that gap. And it like solidly burnt me out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And trying to still be an artist, that was the other thing, is that I then got like a couple really great gigs personally as a director to go and do stuff, and I wanted to go do that too. But then like the company suffered. The company that I was working for free for then suffered because I wanted to take the gigs that were actually paying.
Yeah.
And that were going to develop me artistically, not just as a producer or executive. So like, how is that, you know, what is your experience with that?
Because burnouts are really weird because it leaves you kind of in this state of apathy, which is one of the most frightening states of mind I can be in. Like when I find myself really bored and just kind of apathetic and just not caring, it really scares me. Just because, you know, I've always defined myself as a musician who's passionate and who's just determined and has a vision. So when I might find myself in that state, I realize that I've gone too far. Like that I've mentally just completely run myself dry and that I need to just step back. I definitely...
Wow, yeah, like saying that like really... It actually gave me chills when you're like, I realize that I'm in apathy.
Yeah.
Is when you're in burnout. Yeah. And you just like can't connect or can't care or can't be passionate. That is frightening.
That is very frightening because you feel like, you know, the very fuel that is my creativity and my artistry is gone. And why? Because I overdid it. I went without consideration for my, you know, mind and my body. I just kept going. I like, for example, right now I feel pretty burnt out, like after this project, and we had a couple other things, and it was a really busy spring. So even something as simple as like posting stuff on social media about like my next concert, I'm like, who gives a shit if I'm being completely frank.
And you're like, ugh.
And then I'm thinking, no, people actually care. It's just you, because you are done and you want to just sleep all day now. You're in that state of mind. So it's I don't know how I read things and I listen to people and I know I'm supposed to be listening to like inward. To like my body and to the way my body's reacting to certain situations, if it's stressful, if it's just a lot of work, it's a learning process for me to understand my own sort of fatigue a little bit better.
And I guess the question is, like, why do we end up in burnout?
Yeah. All the aforementioned.
Why?
it's the stress. It's the stress, and also this like perfectionist vision that we have that, oh, okay, we're gonna make these projects beautiful. I'm gonna be this and that and X, Y, and Z, and you're just constantly striving and not realizing that, you know, you gotta sometimes go to the gas station and pump up. You can't just go. Even cars need that. You know, after 200 kilometers of driving, you gotta go in and put in some fuel. But we don't do that.
Perfectionism.
It's almost like a meme, you know, when people are like, I want to have a me day. But it's important to have a me day. Even your day offs are sometimes, you're still writing emails. You're still, like, thinking about things.
Or just resting is actually, that reminds me of recently. So I've been training a lot for a triathlon. And people say, like, well, how many days a week do you train? And I say every day. But I'm not every day working out, because on the days off is actually when your muscle repairs and grows.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that day off is not training. Yeah. It's actually allowing the body to repair itself and to grow.
Yeah.
And I think we need to be thinking about that more, that like the days off are not off as in you're not doing anything. It's actually where you're allowing healing and growth
processing
to happen.
This is literally why we sleep. We sleep to give our body a chance to sort through, like, your brain sorts through memories and mental figments and stuff, and that's why we dream. And then your body repairs things, wounds, you grow, you, like, you know, otherwise we would just be like awake 24 hours, you know. This is why we need those days off, or this is why you need to sometimes just get away. Like, I've been making a point of, like, once a month at least going for a walk by myself, just like to the water. No phones, nothing. I know it's dangerous in an urban area to not have your phone on you. But whatever. If I get mugged, I get mugged, whatever. So just go by the water and just silence, just like some silence, just because I feel like sometimes it's just the mental noise is always there. And that doesn't help the burnout. And I don't know if it's the same with you. It's actually funny because for me, my body and mind are always delayed. So if I finish a really big project or a couple of different, like a busy period, I don't really feel anything for a few days. Like for 4 or 5 days, I'm fine, la la la, I still have energy. And then like a week later, you're like,
you'll crush.
Yeah, it's just like suddenly, like, you want to sleep like 12, 13 hours. Like, I don't understand it. Yeah. I didn't do anything this week, but
it's the accumulation, and also I think probably like the realization that you don't have to be functioning that high anymore. But to come back to your point about like perfectionism and, you know, feeling like the pressure to, you know, have something come out not just artistically perfect, but also maybe administratively perfect, and you know, all this perfectionism that exists that actually doesn't really serve us very
much. No, it doesn't. It really doesn't. And again, it's because of this constant fear of you have to do everything right. You have to be the good artist and the good administrator and good executive person. You have to be good because you're the core of it all. You know, you're picturing this project, and you're like, if I fall apart, it's game over. So I need to be on my A game, and that stress is enough already, because that's just like the baseline stress for you as an executive director. Like, it's always there, you know.
Yeah.
Can't get away from it. And so, especially when you're working, like, for example, for our project, the recent project, you know, I'm working with like some of Canada's most high profile musicians. You know, I don't want to mess up something simple.
And,
look like a fool. So, you know, I want to make sure that everything is done properly and everything is in order. And then, you know, once the project is over, you just like feel that stress. You're like, oh, like the remnants of it.
Totally. And I actually have to say that, you know, part of, you know, I'm disabled, I have a brain injury, and I realized that, you know, even though sometimes I had a system where like I could indicate to people that I wasn't doing very well, or that, you know, maybe I wasn't going to be able to process things as quickly, or I might start messing up my words or something, that fear of falling apart in front of people, or not being able to meet people's expectations of what an executive director, quote unquote, is supposed to be and supposed to look like is so frightening. Yeah. And, you know, there's this, all this talk of like, oh, just, you know, do what you can and be who you are or whatever. And it's like, no, but you don't understand.
Yeah.
If I do that, then everything falls apart and everyone gets angry at me.
Yeah. Because you're the
everyone's going to get pissed off at me if I can't act and be in a way that they expect me to be, which is a high functioning, you know, executive director and creator, et cetera. And I've always felt like there wasn't any space for me to fail or for me to not be pretending, at least, that I was at my top game.
Yeah, we have to be always very professionally sanitized. That's what we have to be.
Oh, wow. That's... Wow, can we get into that? To professionally sanitized?
Yeah, because it's like you just have to come across as very much in control, as confident and as in charge and comfortable in your skin, and you have to do all the work and you have to make sure that everybody's needs are met, and there's 10 on the other side. You know, you're a human being, you know, you also have 10 other things that you're worrying about. So, but your aura and your presence needs to be very sort of like proper and sanitized, professionally sanitized. I like that. I'm gonna stick with that.
Yeah,
I'm gonna stick with that. It is
professionally sanitized.
Yeah, just like no rough edges. I'm here. Yes. Oh, you want extra money? No problem. Oh, you want another chair? No problem. Like all the demands are met. You're this one person army, you know, that you have to.
And inside you're like dying. Falling apart. Inside you're dying.
Basically.
I believe one time when we were talking, you shared a quote from Gary Kulesha that I wanted you to bring out again. What was that again?
It was, it's none of your business how people feel about your work.
Yes,
that's what that was.
Yeah,
that was in the context of
that, like, needs to be crocheted somewhere.
Yeah, I know. I know. I even told him. It's like I've been telling that code to other people, and he just doesn't react to it because he doesn't react.
Because he's Gary.
He's Gary. But yeah, I mean, that was in the context of a piece of music. But I think it can be extended to, like, you know, you put what you put out there, and if somebody doesn't like it or loves it, it's a separate process from, or it's a separate part of the creative process. Like it has nothing to do with you, because these two things,
none of your business.
It's none of your business. Yeah, and it could be in conflict.
None of your business. It's none of your business if the audience likes it, or it's none of your business if they like it, or
if they hate it, because, you know, you might think,
or if they hate it.
Well, because it goes both ways. Sometimes you create something, or you do a thing, your work, that you think is not that great, and then people tell you that it's fantastic. That also has happened to me multiple times, and vice versa, where I create something that I think is very ingenious, and then people are like, oh, it's pretty good, it's interesting, and then like, oh no, they hated it. So it's not always in concert, you know, these reactions to a work of art, or even in this case, if you are managing a project, for example, you know, you put all the work and then people on the other side are not satisfied, or vice versa, you just do something. Yeah,
that's so hard when, like, we really do take in, I mean, it's something I'm trying to work on right now as well, is we really do take in, you know, what other people think of our work, whether it's artistic or administrative. You know, we want people to like us and to be happy and to enjoy what we've put out there. And then when they don't, it is like this, it really is like a shock to the system. And it can be really, like, you can take it in a lot, but that quote is kind of like relieving, you know, us of that, you know, that you shouldn't be taking in everything. And it's not actually your responsibility to take in
that's
all of their.
Yeah. I think that second part is responsibility. I think it's not responsibility. Your responsibility as the artist is to create the work and put it out there. And then once it's out there.
And your responsibility as a producer is to, you know, get the thing produced, not necessarily make everyone happy.
Yeah. No.
I mean, if you can make everyone happy,
fantastic,
along the way,
good for you.
Great. But sometimes you can't.
No, you can't.
And sometimes, you know, like, there are things sometimes that, like, budgetarily, like, you're like, that's not possible. That, you know, we, or even personnel. Oh my God. I don't know if you've had this, but like trying to produce opera right now is so challenging because you don't like this. There's so little stage managers and production managers. And then if they are, they're very green. So like as a seasoned producer who's been a production manager and a stage manager, you're kind of like trying to help them along.
Yeah.
Or like you can't get rental stuff. Or spaces are really challenging, especially like when we had all the masking stuff during COVID. And you're trying so hard to make everything work and trying to keep people happy, and people just are not happy. And I know I talked to a lot of other producers who were like, it's been really challenging and hard and like emotionally challenging because people just are not happy. But I guess, you know, trying to relieve yourself of that maybe it's not your responsibility all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. It really isn't. I think everybody has to kind of slowly learn themselves a little bit better. I'm certainly doing that. Like just learning in which areas I put too much pressure on myself, in which areas am I too relaxed, and kind of like when to know to stop or when to know to push. You know, it's just this constant learning of, and also changes with age. I think I'm getting a little older, so my tolerance is getting a little lower for a whole lot of things, you know, whether it's internal or external. So I think it's learning and listening to yourself a little bit too. It's part of it, makes things a little bit better.
That's actually through my recovery and burnout, which is still ongoing, by the way. Like true burnout takes years to recover from. And that's actually part of it, is trying to, you know, distance myself a little bit from, not a little bit, like actually really distance myself from other people's emotions and feelings, like that their emotions and feelings. And I'm doing what I can to, you know, obviously have things happen in a way that is equitable and fair and whatever. But, you know, I'm not going to be able to meet everyone's expectations all the time. And all I can do is the best that I can do in the moment. And if it doesn't meet other people's needs all the time,
too bad.
You know, what are you going to do?
Too bad.
What are you going to do? You know, like if I had all the money in the world and I had three other Elenas, then maybe. But I also hear, like, you know, both you and I have worked in some of the bigger organizations, or arts organizations in the country, and they kind of still operate in the same way as well.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's on the edge of burnout. Yeah. Everyone's trying to make things work with, you know, the budget they have, which is always never enough.
No. Somehow.
So even to say that, like, if there were three of me and, you know, well, yeah, if there were three of me and unlimited budget, then I'm sure it'd be
That'd
fun.
Be great, yeah.
But that's not ever the fact, I think, in any level of organization. So maybe it's our expectations of, you know, people are trying to meet these things, but maybe we can't always do it, and kind of like allow that to also be in a reality.
Absolutely.
We are coming up to the end of our podcast. Is there anything else that you just like that you wanted to say, or that maybe as we've been talking kind of caught your mind, or that you've been sitting with recently?
It's just the whole idea of patience has been something that's been on my mind for a while, for the past couple of months, and sort of like thinking about how much patience you allow yourself and others, especially when given in professional settings, I think, and in artistic endeavors. And I think we touched on it today quite a bit in terms of, like, you know, give yourself time. Just give yourself some time to breathe, to process, to learn. And not everything has to happen on the first try, or not everything happens the right way, or not everything happens when you think it should happen. And sometimes it's better for things to happen later even. And I think just given the theme of the podcast being compassionate, I think that patience and compassion are really, I think, deeply interrelated.
So we'll say that, like, the theme of this podcast today was patience.
Patience and compassion. That would be nice.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for chatting today, and I look forward to our continued conversation. And Friday the 13th in what month?
October 13th. That's right. Yeah.
Oh, it's so great. October 13th.
It's beautiful.
Is when
Halloween and everything. It's beautiful. Halloween. It's beautiful. Love it.
Is when Resurgence.
Recurrence, yeah.
Recurrence.
That's actually almost a better title. We should have called it Resurgence. We're going to call it Resurgence. We're going to change the name.
I do that with all of your albums. I call them something really
something funny. Slightly different.
Interlocking. Inter. What is it?
Microlocking, interlocking. It's beautiful.
Microtonal.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's, I love it.
Oh, man. Great. Well, thank you. And looking forward to chatting with you later.
Thanks for having me, Lena.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Compassionate Revolution, a podcast by Loose Tea Music Theater. We hope you found the perspectives explored in this episode thought-provoking and action-inspiring. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast so you never miss an episode. And if you haven't yet, please go to the Apple Podcast to rate and review this podcast so other people can join us too.